And we're back, listeners. Sorry about that little bit of dead air. We are here with Alex Matthews.
Yes.
And Isam, just Isam? Okay. Yes. It's a man so cool, he has one name. All right. So, guys, tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing. You have a booth at the vendor section, correct?
Yes, that's right. So, I'm Alex Matthews. I'm the national chair of Restore the Fourth, which is an advocacy organization against surveillance, against mass surveillance specifically, with 24 chapters across the country. And we are lucky enough to be here today with Isam, who does have a second name, but I'm going to keep that undisclosed for the moment. And Isam is an artist resident here in New York City. And we invited him on the show because his experiences speak to the challenges of dealing with artistic production and creativity in today's surveillance state in the United States. And so Mr. Atiyah ran into some trouble with the NYPD a couple of years back. And there I go. I disclose your last name.
Yeah. Totally okay. It's totally okay.
That's okay. But perhaps you could tell us a little bit of your story, and then we can move on to a discussion.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for having me, by the way, Alex. I appreciate it. My name is Isam, and what I started with, my story sort of begins having been in the military. I served for 3.5 years as a geospatial analyst, and once I got to New York and sort of in the run-up to the election of 2008, I started becoming much more politically aware, a lot of it inspired by my time in the service and sort of having been disillusioned by, you know, what it is that we believe America stands for while I was in Iraq and the morality of war and all of those things. And I came back to the city, and there's quite a disconnect between the incredibly, you know, right position of the military and the sort of antithesis left position of New York, and which
we're in a liberal city. Oh no! I had no idea. Get me out of here.
But it caused conflict in me with the sort of information that I was consuming on a daily basis, like the mainstream media and whatnot. And so I started to sort of look for other sources of information and started discovering this very faint conversation around drones beginning to be used domestically, which wasn't something that was being talked about by most people. And I had experience with drones, aka UAVs, while I was in the military. There was only a few of them at the time, to be honest. It was a very young technology, and we were using the Predator to, you know, follow troops on the ground and collect imagery and sort of give an eye in the sky for people on a mission. And, you know, that quickly evolved into them being armed. And this was after my time in the service. They began, you know, using them for these, you know, covert strikes against against insurgents. And then the Customs and Border Patrol acquired the technology and has been using it for a while now, patrolling the Mexican and Canadian borders. And then I discovered what really like tipped me on to the sort of negativity behind it was when the FAA and the NYPD were discussing the legality of using them over the skies of New York. And this conversation wasn't taking place between anybody, really. It was a very covert conversation. It was a FOIA request done by an incredibly obscure news source that revealed this, and it really turned me off, and I started doing a lot of research and found that no one wanted to talk about this. And as a resident of this city and as a citizen of this country and somebody that served and as an artist, it sort of seemed to me that I had a duty to try to create some sort of conversation. And that's when I came up with this what's now become known as the Drone Campaign. And it started out as a series of street signs that mimic Department of Transportation street signs that said things like authorized drone strike zone, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., including Sundays, and local statutes awesome. Enforced by drone. Yeah, it was a fun project. They were mostly accompanied by quotes from the founding fathers like Adams and Jefferson about liberty and justice and freedom. And and the nature of government and the role of the press and things of that nature, and to sort of create this duality, you know, in the viewer and the street sign, hopefully to create a bit of a sense of cognitive dissonance and, you know, force a reaction. I put up about 50 of those around Manhattan and Brooklyn, you know, in artistically minded places as well as very politically influenced places as well. So like in front of the United Nations, in front of the Pakistani consulate, in front of like Opus Dei, and then around like arts organizations as well, like in front of the Guggenheim and the Met and MoMA and places of that nature. And, you know, like I was set into this thinking that I was going to be like Banksy working undercover for years before anybody ever discovered that anything was awry or anything was happening. And mm-hmm. Much to my surprise, it only took about a month before the media really caught on and was, you know, Aaron Burnett covered it on CNN and a bunch of other people because they were really concerned about what this meant. And of course, Ray Kelly at the time, who was the police commissioner, was getting calls and Bloomberg's office was getting calls like, what is this? Is this real? And they had to account for, you know, their actions, and it became a conversation in the city and then, you know, subsequently the nation. And also along with that, because we had to confront the fact that we were uncomfortable with this technology being used domestically, we had to discuss the morality of the way they're being used overseas. And, you know, which I think is a very, very important conversation, because we don't seem to realize that the technology isn't as surgical as one would, you know, like as the press and the government especially would have us believe. You know, these are Hellfire missiles. This is the same technology that, you know, F-14s are carrying. Mm-hmm. And so why is that any more, you know, surgical than when an F-14 is tasked to do the job? You know, we all know that the F-14 doing it causes a lot of damage.
Yes.
Why does the drone doing it automatically mean less damage?
There may be an element here that the automated nature and the unmanned nature of the drone leads people in a sense to repose more trust in it, because it feels like an automated system that is therefore more reliable than the potential for human error. But what people rule out of the equation is the human beings who are making the decisions as to the areas to target and the process by which things are targeted, and who are designing the algorithms.
True, and also depending on the technology, some of it's not automated at all. Like the Predator is not an automated system. No. That has like it's piloted by a 3-man team, you know, working around the clock to run that ground, and a ground crew as well, you know, so there's nothing automated about it at all. It functions just like any other aircraft, only the person isn't in the aircraft.
Hmm. So tell me what happened next.
So after that project, the NYPD and the city of New York didn't respond very well. And I sort of discovered initially via a friend of mine who worked in the hotel industry and, you know, was a, you know, administrator sort of person. They received an email from the Department of Counterterrorism in the NYPD stating that they were looking for evidence in regards to these street signs. They supplied a picture of the street signs and gave a detective's name, and this email went out to the homeowners association, security firms, building owners, basically anybody in the city dealing with property and the security of property and the ownership of property. And I was blown away that they were tasking the Division of Counterterrorism of the NYPD on this case. And it really made me rethink what I was doing, and then the means in which I was creating this conversation. And after some time passed, the dialogue sort of fizzled, and then Congress passed a bill, and the FAA, you know, opened up the airspace, and it seemed like the exact opposite of what was intended to take place with the conversation was happening. I mean, there's always a reaction, right? So, like, I think the people that want this technology reacted and decided maybe we should start paving the road to make this a little bit more accessible for us in the United States. But the people weren't really talking about the negativity and or the possible implications anymore. And so I decided that maybe the work wasn't done. One night, it's kind of funny how this was inspired. I was trying to figure out how else to go about creating this conversation, and putting this in people's face in the same way, using sort of street art tactics in New York City. And I remember watching, there's this company called Van Wagner, which owns a ton of advertising space in the city, similar to Lamar, which owns advertising space around the country, and CBS Outdoor. It's all billboards and phone mm-hmm. booth kiosks and things of that nature. And I see this van pull up with a little yellow light blinking on the roof, and it's plastered with Van Wagner logos. And this is on my corner, by the way, where I live, and there's a deli there. And I was like 2 in the morning or something. I was coming home. I went to the deli, and I see this van pull up. A guy get out, screw gun, opens this phone booth, out comes an ad, in goes a new ad, screws the phone booth closed, and is gone in less than a minute. And I was like, oh my God, this is brilliant. And so I figured out what they're using to open these up, and like what the material was that the ad was printed on, and sort of like, and what the replacement schedule was and all of that. And I designed a few fake public service announcements. Just like the street signs were posing as official sort of, you know, propaganda or rules, these were posing as, you know, public service announcements, letting the people know that this technology is being used. And it was a little bit more, I think, tongue-in-cheek than the first project. The first project being that it's a street sign was very sterile and I think caused a lot more fear. This was a little bit more tug-in-cheek. There was, you know, a predator shooting a missile at a running family, and the running family
sounds hilarious.
Yeah, but the running family was like, is taken from that street sign that you find along the southern border of the United States about like sort of being watching out for running immigrant families, and which was also reappropriated by Banksy in a piece he did in Los Angeles. And so I sort of took that as...
So for culturally sophisticated NYPD officers, they wouldn't have had a problem with it because they would understand the network of artistic reference that you were trying to capitalize on.
Yeah, I'm not sure, so sure that took place, but...
Yeah, so how did that work out?
I mean, the project was fantastic. What it ended my subsequently being arrested, though. What I did was I sort of went out in the way that the Van Wagner people go out and sort of posed as them, and I put up 120 or so over the course of 2 evenings. And after about a month went by, I thought to myself, like, okay, they must not really care, because at that point I had done a couple interviews, both of which were anonymous, but there were enough pieces of information in them to sort of figure out who I was. You know, like, there aren't many military veterans that were GIS analysts that went to art school in New York. You know, right. I don't imagine that pool of people is very large. And so I sort of assumed that they probably knew who I was a while ago, and if they cared, they would have caught me long ago.
Right.
Eventually I get a knock on my door at 6 o'clock in the morning and get hauled off to a jail cell. And you know, that sort of rocked my world, and I didn't really know how to handle it and how to deal with it at first. And when I originally was trying, when the police were trying to interview me, and I kind of like understanding my rights and understanding sort of the implications of talking to the detectives before you see a lawyer and a judge, you know, I didn't say anything, but they were telling me that
I think that was very wise, by the way.
They were telling me that I was going to be charged with vandalism, essentially. And, you know, like, as part of the stipulation of me not speaking, when they told me that was a felony, I was like, okay, yeah, that's great. Like, let me talk to my lawyer. And I go through the booking process, and I spend, like, the next 36 hours in jail. And then when I get out, I realize that my charges, in fact, were much more serious. I was being charged with 3 felonies and 2 misdemeanors, and one of the misdemeanors was 56 counts. It was grand larceny, possession of stolen property, possession of a firearm for an antique revolver that was my great-great-grandfather's, which in New York City is legal because, like, you can't get ammunition for that anymore. They also wanted to claim that I stole that. And then there was possession of a forged instrument, which wasn't one of the more serious charges, but it was the one that was 56 counts of. And that's a regulation that's written to protect people from identity theft, like fake IDs and fake credit cards. But instead they decided to use it to try to prosecute me against using the NYPD's logo on a satirical poster. In the end, I ended up having to have a fundraiser because, you know, the way our political system works and the way our legal system works, I sort of understand that money is really what makes things function. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I could have spent $2,000 on an attorney who would have gotten me 2 years probation and, you know, community service for the rest of my life. And that really wasn't my goal in the end. And I had spent some time, you know, on the phone talking to relatively high profile lawyers like Arthur Idala, for instance, who represented T.O. when he went through that rape trial and got him acquitted, you know. So, but the fees were quite high, like in the $30,000 ballpark. So,
right.
I ended up throwing a fundraiser. We had a bunch of a few bands play, and a bunch of art was donated by various street artists in the city, and we were able to raise the money, and I was able to sit around for a year and a half, and eventually the charges were dismissed. So,
well, congratulations. And
thank you.
We are very glad that you're a free man today.
It's a big weight off my shoulders.
Yes, absolutely. And when did you hear that the charges were being dropped?
It actually just took place in March of this year, so not too terribly long ago.
Well, congratulations on that. I think that this is a case that came to our attention when you were being loaded up with the charges, and it seemed very interesting to me, and so I wrote it up on my blog at warrantless.org, and I was kind of pissed, and it may be that I used some unparliamentary language here and there, but in particular, I thought that the 56 charges for forged instruments were astoundingly abusive, in that it is well established First Amendment law that it is perfectly okay to use the logos of other organizations for purposes of free expression, and particularly if you have a political or satirical purpose in using them. It's just like, this is black letter law. The NYPD should have known this. They shouldn't even have tried this kind of thing. And it was all, it seemed to me, about them being embarrassed and wanting to lash out at you and bring you into the toils of the police state.
That's as a absolutely result. What it was about. The arresting officer, in fact, said to me, you know, you pissed people off, you're going to have to face the consequences.
Right. And so it shows, I think, how unruly police departments can be when there is no oversight and no discussion of the kinds of things that they are trying to do. So on the one side, no discussion of the proposal for the NYPD to start using drones in New York City airspace, and that is worrying enough. And on the other side, retaliation against people who would take issue with that, because it would intrude on the NYPD's whole sort of we're our own private army and no one else gets to tell us what to do kind of ethos, which has been such a big issue in this city over the last couple of years. I wanted to talk a little bit, or to ask you what the implications have been for you in the way that you are expressing your artistic work. Are you feeling more nervous now, or are you feeling vindicated, or what kind of work are you doing, and is it as politically confrontational as this work was?
Yeah, that's a good question. To be honest, I was very nervous for a while, especially while my court
was, I would be too.
Especially while my case was still pending, yeah, for just cause, I suppose. And it definitely made me rethink the way I wanted to continue to pursue my artistic endeavors, because I'm classically trained in art as a photographer. After my military service, I went to the School of Visual Arts here in New York City, and I studied photography. And my work began to become very political in the photographic world. And I found that there wasn't much of an outlet for that. You know, like the gallery world isn't super interested in this commercial-looking, satirical, political work. And and the public, you know, like the...
Unless it's got Warhol written at the bottom of it?
Possibly, yeah. but also periodicals are very, you know, hesitant to take very politically charged messaging, because they have advertisers to please and all of that stuff, and they don't want to be too opinionated in any one way or the other.
Right.
So it was a tough market. And then when I discovered this as a medium to work in, I really enjoyed it. I'm still pursuing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the tactics have changed a bit. I think What I'm now trying to do is work in conjunction with NGOs and other nonprofits that have similar messaging and similar goals, and try to come up with the funding and the permissions to pursue these projects in a legitimate fashion that's not going to get me in any trouble. Mm. My background in the military as a geospatial analyst I've always been very interested in maps and intrigued by the, you know, geography and the way we understand the world we live in from above. And so my latest project is actually sort of involving imagery that will eventually be captured by satellite and sort of transforming the space we live in without us necessarily knowing it while we're in that space and walking down the streets, but changing the digital landscape of the world we live in.
Hmm. That sounds really cool work. A last question before we go to break, but what do you see ahead in the world of drone technology and in the kind of a society that you would expect to see us living in the next 10 years, 15 years? Give your futurist prediction.
Yeah, my futurist prediction is a bleak one, to be honest. I would like to imagine that we could reach some sort of homeostasis as a people and between people and government and the use of technology. But seeing how quickly this is evolving and how little the people of the country know about, you know, the evolution and the capabilities of the technology, I fear that soon we will see swarms of these being used by the NYPD and other agencies acting totally autonomously to track people using the facial recognition and retinal scanner technology that exists. And I imagine eventually within my lifetime, some of them will be armed. It's already been talked about by police chiefs in Texas and other states to put tasers and salt shotguns and, you know, like non-lethal weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, we take that step, and I don't think it's too long before we're actually arming the predators that monitor the borders with hellfires. I think it's this very slippery slope we've begun to...
We would tend to agree, and at Restore the Fourth, we are certainly going to be working actively to try and make sure that that future does not come about.
And I appreciate that.
That's very kind of you. So I'm Alex Matthews, and we are talking with New York City artist Assam Attia. And you can find us on the web at restorethefourth.com. And thank you very much for coming in and being our guest today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Alex.
Okay.
Take care.
All right, all of our listeners here that are on IRC in the Radio-Statler channel, if you have any questions, now would be a fantastic and phenomenal time for you guys to ask them. And if you happen to be listening and are not on IRC, you can join us by hopping on irc.2600.net, and the channel is #radio-statler. So, do we have any questions from the IRC channel?
I'm seeing that there was a reaction on IRC going, uh-oh, a limey, I think I've been rumbled. This is serious.
I'm a little worried. We're not even seeing... Are people on IRC? Hello?
Are we on the air?
I certainly hope so.
Was that entire discussion wasted? Certainly hope not. It was a good discussion.
Well, we have it recorded.
Oh, there we go. We have somebody.
Do you guys have any... Oh, no need to yell, Fun Socks. Jeez. No questions, Fun Socks? Well, if you guys have any questions, you can ask them during, and we can come back to this later. But Alex, you have somebody else here that's come to visit?
Yes, I do. So I'd like to welcome to the studio Zaki Mannion. Zaki is the head of Restore the Force San Francisco Bay Area, and we've invited him in so we can talk a little bit about the legislative agenda for surveillance reform and the kinds of organizing efforts that are going on across the country to try and avoid the pervasive surveillance dystopia that we have just been discussing. So Zaki, welcome to the show.
Hi, Alex.
So why don't you say a little bit about yourself and about how you came to be working with Restore the Force, and then we'll proceed to the discussion.
Hi, I'm Zaki Mannion. I live in San Francisco, and I am sort of a technology entrepreneur. I build machines that diagnose diseases with lasers is the simplest explanation of what my career is, and I've been doing that for about 10 years. And the Snowden revelations were a worldview changer. I assumed that mass surveillance was going on. I certainly knew that the network was vulnerable to it as an engineer. I did not assume that every system that could be exploited would be exploited. And I think that is the world that we now live in. And for the last year, I have been working in San Francisco to take an organization that formed organically after the Snowden revelations and turn it into something that can endure and make a difference and provide an outlet for people to make meaningful change against mass surveillance.
That is awesome, and you've been doing terrific work. And I know that you organized events such as Shame Against Feinstein and stuff like this too, trying to move our political system a little bit forward. I see that we are getting some challenges on the IRC channel. Yes, Restore the Fourth is about the Fourth Amendment. That is the one dealing with searches and seizures, and specifically requiring individualized warrants based on probable cause before you search or seize people's papers or effects. We are defenders of that, including me, even though I have a British accent, because I would like to assert against the IRC channel that I am, in fact, a US citizen. I just don't sound like one. What makes the Fourth Amendment so important in this, Zaki?
So I think there's two reasons. I think it's very important that you have an organization that is dedicated only to the Fourth Amendment. I think that's part of the reason why we need to have a Restore the Fourth. The Fourth Amendment exists for a historical reason. It exists because one of the reasons for the American Revolution, one of the injustices that was committed that caused the founders to commit treason against the British crown, was the concept of general warrants. The concept that the government would search your belongings, your paper, your house, looking for evidence of non-specific crimes. And the reason we need a Restore the Fourth is, at all levels of government, the government is engaged in practices that are essentially logging and recording and maintaining a file on every human being on the face of the earth that can be searched at a later date for crimes. And that we've created an architecture in which criminality is a symptom of being politically unfavorable, of offending people in power, rather than maintaining a society based on rule of law.
Which brings us right back to the case of Assam here, because truthfully, the NYPD really had to struggle to find anything that was against the law that he had actually done as part of his artistic project. But part of the concomitant of the problem here is that our laws have become so broad and so poorly defined that you're no longer talking about using the justice system to target the worst of the worst or to target the people who are meaningfully harming our communities. You're picking the criminal and then finding the crime to fit around the criminal. And that is a very dangerous situation for any society to be in. If we had that kind of system at the time that the founders were around, then they would not have been able to get going. So we have been working to try and create grassroots groups around the country. We have 25 chapters at the moment. I think that's right, Zaki.
Yes.
We are here today in New York City to encourage people to get involved with the New York City chapter, and indeed in the chapters where you're from. You can find a list of them at restoreforth.com. And we are working extensively on surveillance reform, both in Congress and in state legislatures at the moment. We have a comment on the IRC that the political effort against mass surveillance is arguably one of the most important of our time. Thank you, Bash RC. I would tend to agree. If these systems are permitted to run their course, then I think there are some really dark times ahead. Let us chart out a little bit of what those dark times would entail. One thing that we really have to pay close attention to is the potential for the surveillance state to surveil our elected leaders, to hold the secrets of our political leaders in their hand. There's been some evidence that such things are going on already. And what this does is, if you allow unfettered surveillance, if you allow people to conduct mass surveillance in the name of stopping terrorism, and if you allow them to target people and then one hop from those people and then one hop from those people and one hop from them, then so many people get caught up in it that it is possible for the surveillance state to become essentially the ultimate authority in the state. There's no way that anyone can articulate a meaningful defiance of the surveillance state trying to constrain its budget or to constrain its activities, because exactly as they were trying to do with Essam Attiyah, then they will mobilize against them too quickly for any meaningful change to be able to occur. So I'd like to get both of your comments on that possibility.
So the surveillance state is a kind of super system that that demands compliance and cooperation without it even explicitly threatening you. So the ways in which the NSA can dominate society are not just by explicitly blackmailing politicians or doing things like what happened with Martin Luther King, where the FBI sends you a file of your various improprieties and demands that you commit suicide. The NSA, simply by existing and by people being aware of the power and the data that it has and its total dominance of the network that underlies our civilization, simply demands cooperation by its very existence. That is the fundamental problem. And, you know, the people who are opposing it, who are trying to introduce friction into the society, basically think that there is a short window of opportunity right now where we can meaningfully resist, where the NSA is still dependent on popular legitimacy and the popular will to continue to function, where we can induce enough friction in this system that it might change its behavior. The end result of this system is a system in which you have no choice but to comply.
I've actually witnessed that firsthand in the work that I do. I've enlisted the help of many people, other artists and close friends of mine. And you know, New York City is definitely a model of the melting pot that is America, with many people from all over the world and different states of citizenship and legality of being here. And there were many people that I met that didn't even want to talk to me, unless in person, about this work. Via text message, via email, it was not allowed. Like, they were so fearful of the potential backlash against them because of what we know now about. And even at the time, this was before the Snowden leaks. I mean, Thomas Drake had come out and revealed what he had revealed. But there was always, even before Snowden, and sort of like the there wasn't, you know, the same sort of mass awareness about the surveillance state back then. There was always this sense that it was taking place anyway. Mm-hmm. And you're right that the presence of the NSA does psychologically affect all of us. I mean, it definitely now affects the way I operate and the way I think and the things that I say to people. I try to be as candid about life as possible, but I definitely think of, you know, the file that must exist on me within the NSA and all of the texts that I've sent and the emails that I've sent and what that profile must look like.
Yeah. So they don't even have to do anything with it necessarily. They just have to have it and have it be known that they have it. We have actually managed to furnish some of the first empirical proof that it's not just us in the room being particularly paranoid about this. This is a general chill on freedom of speech, freedom of artistic expression, freedom of expression in general, and particularly freedom of religious practice. But we have some research which I'll be presenting in a lightning talk later today that shows that as a direct result of the Snowden revelations and people figuring out more about what is going on, people are searching less on search terms that they think will get them in trouble with the government, and also search terms that are privacy sensitive but that won't. Things like searching on eating disorder or other important but embarrassing healthcare information. You have a decrease in searches for erectile dysfunction, for example. And some people are like, is that a bigger thing? Is that something we have to worry about? Actually, yes, it is. This is people's health we're talking about. And people are chilled in a generalized way because it is not focused and because relatively few people are targeted to the extent that you have been, Assam, by this system. But they are still quietly more cautious than I think they should be in a free society.
Absolutely. I think it's what I've witnessed as an interesting observation is I think that this technology, though not designed to take it to prosecute everyone at in the nation, I think will eventually become a means of very easily blackmailing anybody that has any opinion of dissent. And or wants to get into politics and try to help change the system. It's going to be a very easy way to, pull up evidence of this, anybody being a problem in society.
Yeah, who has a clean sheet?
Right. No one.
As Hamlet says, treat everyone according to their deserts, and who shall escape whipping? Mm-hmm. But there is also a question there, which is maybe if everyone has dirt and if the dirt on everybody is known, then maybe we would no longer freak out to an extent about people's sexual improprieties or about things that are personal and don't necessarily speak to their trustworthiness for public office. So maybe there's a possibility there, Zaki.
I don't think that the mechanism of control is as explicit as simply blackmailing people about their sexual foibles or their past marijuana use or whatever.
That's becoming less and less of an issue as the years go by.
Yes, but one of the nice things about a society of pervasive communication and free publishing of information is that we sort of do experience humanity more as it is rather than people's sort of presentations of themselves, which sort of on the whole is a good thing. In many ways, allowing people to be public about parts of themselves that they had to keep private before. Mm. The mechanism of control is more subtle than that. The mechanism of control is the ability is to take away people's ability to control the timing, the context in which that information is released. And so essentially the ability to automate psychological operations, as we've seen with what GCHQ's tools are, is automated psychological operations against political groups. So the private information that you gather is then used and essentially can be automated into subversion tools that can be deployed at a mass scale so that that information can be revealed in contexts and in situations where it is most harmful rather than just simply like broadcasting it to the public.
Hmm. So in a sense, one of the powers it's depriving people of is the power of fashioning different personas for different circumstances, the power of marketing themselves strategically and forcing them to have a single self-presentation to the government and to all audiences. It's not like there will be some things that you tell your wife and some things that you tell to your mom and some things that you tell to the public and that they can be different things. It may be that there is damage there, that it's not simply a matter of forcing people to be honest about themselves. It's also constraining their freedom of expression to an extent by forbidding that kind of self-refashioning. What do you think?
I agree 100%. I think it's a huge travesty, though, because that's exactly what this nation is based on. We're sort of required in order to function as a society to have individuality, You know, like, this place is supposed to be a place of unique people creating and conspiring, you know, to come up with brilliant ideas. And I think when you stifle that freedom of thought and that freedom of expression, you also stifle innovation technologically, idealistically, you know, philosophically. And it becomes a problem and will eventually, I think, lead to a less relevant society.
So in an extent, what you're saying is that a kind of frontier is necessary for creativity. There has to be an ability for self-reinvention. And so if you look at the Absolutely. Context of, say, the gold rush in California, who knows who all these tens of thousands of people were who were coming to San Francisco in the hope of striking it rich? Tens of thousands of second sons and ne'er-do-wells and people out to make a quick buck, and probably lots of people who had done terrible things back where they were from. And the society at that point afforded a space for them to reinvent themselves and leave aside their pasts. And great energy and creativity arose out of that. So one of the questions here is, where is that space now? And one of the things that, as internet-interested people, we have to deal with is that the frontier for a while, for the last 20 years, has been the internet. And that was a space for new kinds of self-presentation. And now that kind of potential seems to be being choked off by interested actors, both in government and out of it.
What it is you, the way we as a society discover important new ideas is through the fringe. The fringe is where ideas originate. But the fringe is very threatening to a system that demands total conformity. And what we're looking at, you know, California, the tech industry came out of the counterculture movement. In fact, it came out of the counterculture movement fusing with the defense industrial complex. I mean, that is what the Silicon Valley is. It's this weird hybrid thing of military contractors going to stoned hippies and people who are fans of hallucinogens and inventing technology. That is the environment that we live in the Silicon Valley, and it is really important that those people who are the counterculture exist, otherwise essentially the flow of important new ideas stops, and societal progress can essentially be essentially ground to a halt.
And so part of the process that we are working on in our advocacy and in our blogging and organizing is to challenge the way that we as a society are choosing to define our enemies. And so two generations ago, we might have been talking about the Reds as the enemy. And we're now talking about the terrorists and people who associate with terrorists, or people who have talked with terrorists, or people who have waved at a terrorist in the street once. It is very interesting to see how broad that definition has come to be drawn. So it may have started off as being Al-Qaeda, or maybe Al-Qaeda and associated forces, but now you see through the activities of the Fusion Center domestically that they have targeted a very broad spectrum of behavior under the rubric of terrorism, such that terrorism doesn't really mean anything anymore. It can mean, for example, a glitter protest where some folk in a mall decided to protest against a wall by dropping glitter on the head of some security guards. And that was defined as terrorism. It can constitute a light show over a freeway. The anti-terrorism structure of institutions and law has targeted peace activists, peaceful Muslims. It targeted and disrupted Occupy and perceived that as a far greater threat than the threat of Islamic terrorism, truthfully. And so we see this variety of what Zaki might characterize as being countercultural elements being targeted as being the domestic enemy and being identified with people with whom they really have very little in common, namely Muslim fundamentalists who probably would despise the counterculture.
By the way, that includes all of us participating in this conference.
Oh, absolutely. Good God. If there aren't a whole lot of surveillance state agents at this conference, then I would be shocked. They really wouldn't be doing what they perceive to be their job. So in that sense, how do we create greater space for, let's say, human flourishing, human thriving, and the kind of creativity that was such a stimulus for this country and for the people who have chosen, like myself, to come to this country and to refashion?
It's a really tough question to answer, and my ideals in that field tend to be a little bit libertarian leaning, and that I think creating that space is about doing exactly that, like loosening up. And you have to recognize that there bad things are going to happen in the world. It's a big universe. There's a lot of us, and we have an infinite number of ideals and ideologies and ways of being, and not everyone is going to comply with, you know, with a central state of mind. And we have to sort of accept that we can't prevent bad things from happening. It's not a possibility. No matter how restrictive the government gets and or states become, there is always going to be somebody that dislikes it and is willing to go that extra mile to try to you know, attack it, so to speak, and or, you know, speak their mind against it. And I think it's important that we give human beings the benefit of the doubt for the most part. I mean, obviously, like, the legal structure is set up to protect us, and like, violent murderers should absolutely, you know, suffer the consequences of their actions. But it's not something where, like, these glitter parties and somebody putting up drone signs in the street and
just for example.
Yeah, for example. You know, like, these are not threatening in any way, shape, or form. You know, like, they're not violent crimes, and they should not be treated in the way they're treated. I don't at all. And, you know, it just goes back to, I think, you know, what we just talked about, and the effects are quite negative. And I think we need to, you know, loosen our belt a little bit as a country.
I think that's correct in that the effect of imposing too strict limitations upon the way that people express themselves and the ability of people to work and operate freely is in many ways to create a backlash. You try to turn the screws on too tight and you create resentment. You create more and more people who see the United States as acting as an oppressive state, because it is acting as an oppressive state for more and more subcategories of people.
I agree with that entirely, and I think it creates more enemies.
Right, and sometimes it can veer into the field of crime creation. There have been a lot of cases, and I've covered them, some of them on warrantless.org, where the FBI has a bureaucratic imperative. Okay, it considers it part of its own mission to be to find and disrupt terrorist cells. Lots of agencies are competing in that space, but the FBI definitely feels that way. And so part of what they have done is to find dumb people, vulnerable people, people who are mentally not, you know, totally 100% stable and happy. And to lead them step by step to a point where they are able to take some sort of articulable step that can be identified as terrorism. And so the FBI informants will supply even fake bombs. They will largely orchestrate the plot. And so long as there is some sort of iota of inclination in the suspect, then the FBI is perfectly legally entitled to go to the press and say, look, guys, we found a terrorist. We found another one. Chalk that up on the victory board.
So I think part of the context that all of this is happening with is, on one hand, the state seems incredibly powerful through these surveillance tools. On the other hand, there are core mechanisms by which the state sort of exerts its power and its normal function that are failing it. The state is finding it incredibly difficult to enforce the laws when the laws are being ignored by powerful people, which undermines the state's sort of legitimacy. The state is finding it very difficult to implement policy. You see time and time again, you know, what's happening at the border right now is 10,000 children show up at the border and a $30 billion agency falls over from a relatively small, insignificant impact. the state is very fragile right now, and it is responding to that fragility with increasingly aggressive restrictions and
with
measures.
This is
a fear-based, a fear-driven process. And what we are doing in Restore the Fourth is trying to create a framework by which the state can escape its panic by returning to a set of principles that allow society to move forward and evolve and get past the state of failure that the state is currently in.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate very much the discussion that we have had, and I think we will be wrapping it up. But thank you very much to Esam Atiyah and to Zaki Manyan for being willing to participate in this discussion. You can check us out at the Restore the Fourth booth at the HOPEX event at the Hotel Pennsylvania, or online at restorethefourth.com. Get involved. This is an important fight, and we need your help.